Good morning, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this second argument in our July 29 panel. The next case on for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Morrison. I'll just state for the record what parties are, of course, aware of, which is that we are not holding our oral argument live in person at the Minnesota Judicial Center out of concern for court staff, for the attorneys, for the general public, and for the judges in light of the ongoing national emergency and state emergency arising from the pandemic. We are entertaining the argument by WebEx, a video conferencing tool. And counsel, you should just be aware, if you haven't had an opportunity to argue by WebEx yet, that the technology is not the same as being present. So if there are any glitches or difficulty hearing or seeing any of the participants, including the lawyers and judges, please just alert us somehow and we will pause the argument to try to make sure we're all back in line technologically. Counsel, the rules have not changed. However, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument, 5 minutes for rebuttal for the appellant as well. Counsel, please do state your name as you begin each leg of the argument because we are not keeping a video recording of the proceeding, only an audio recording. Counsel, whenever you're ready to proceed, counsel for appellant, you have the floor.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Bryant. I'm Mark Nyvold representing the appellant, Mr. Morrison. I'm going to focus on the concession of guilt issue. It's rather involved, and I think I can, rather than try to skim through each issue, I would like to focus on that one. The point that the state and the district court relied on to find that there was no concession of guilt seems to be this idea that when defense counsel said that, does the knowledge of a piece of property in the back of your car make it yours? He wasn't referring to what Mr. Morrison, or he was referring to what Mr. Morrison knew from being told by the police that there was a gun in his car. And that defense counsel, therefore, wasn't conceding anything. He was just saying, here's what the police told him. Well, the police, there's no evidence of that. The Scales interview in which that was allegedly said was never played. And if you look at the Scales interview, which I offered as Exhibit 2 at the post-conviction hearing, that's not at all what happened. The officer never said, we found a gun. He didn't say that at all. So and at trial, the state had elicited a very narrow aspect of what was said at the Scales interview. They just have him, the officer Lipinski, testify, well, you know, what did Mr. Morrison say? He said, somebody will be calling you. Okay. So, and the defense counsel never had the Scales tape played. He never cross-examined Officer Lipinski to bring out the fact that you never told Mr. Morrison that a gun had been found. So the jury's proceeding on the basis that Mr. Morrison is somehow aware during the interview already that a gun has been found, so that when defense counsel argues this concession, this awareness of the gun, he's got a factual and evidentiary basis to do that because he's just referring to what the officer told him.
Counsel,
again, there's nothing to show that.
Counsel, if I could interrupt with a question, because I think that that is one way to frame what the district court did and the way that the state has responded. But I also think it might be possible to look at what defense counsel at trial did a slightly differently. And that is to almost make an argument in the alternative. Even assuming there is knowledge, that doesn't equate to possession, or that's not enough or sufficient for possession. And as I look at the closing argument, it's not clear to me that it's accurate to say simply what you've done. It may be more accurate to say that the trial counsel was not conceding a point, but arguing, even assuming that you do believe that jury, that's still not enough.
Well, that's the, it goes from one blunder to another. Not only is he defense counsel, well, he should have elicited what happened during the interview. So because he didn't, that allowed the jury and now the state to say, well, Mr. Morrison already knew that there was a gun when he talked to the officer. The problem with what the scenario you're posing, Your Honor, is that defense counsel had no knowledge, an inadequate knowledge of the facts and the law. Instead of arguing that he wasn't consciously aware of the gun's presence, he argued there was no dominion and control. This gun is in a backpack in the back seat of Mr. Morrison's vehicle. All right. The issue is not dominion and control. Under any interpretation of the law as set out in Florine, that's dominion and control. The issue is, was there a conscious exercise of dominion and control? Did he know the gun was in there? That was the whole point. McKinney, that was the point of McKinney. I put the gun there. He didn't know about it. Defense counsel comes in as if he was completely unfamiliar with the case, has the theory of defense completely backwards.
Counsel, my question is, I guess, to put it more broadly, is it a concession if you are now arguing an alternative basis?
Well, that alternative basis is an professionally unreasonable one, because
no, I understand that's your point, but my question is a specific one. Are you saying that it's always conceding guilt for a defense attorney in a criminal trial to make one argument and then say, essentially, in the alternative, even if the jury believes what the state is trying to prove on that part, there's a separate, independent, alternative argument? Are you saying that that is still conceding guilt to make that pivot in front of the jury?
No, because that's not what was happening here. There was no viable basis to say, okay, if you find that Mr. Morrison has conscious awareness of the gun in the backpack, well, you can acquit him then. You do that, and that's what that's basically what he did. He tried to defend on the basis that he has knowledge of the gun in the backpack, that was his defense, but that the backpack being in the seat right behind him is not dominion and control. Well, that's crazy. If you read Florine, in Florine, they found that a little bit of cocaine left in this abandoned car where Florine was nowhere near. They said that that was constructive possession because there was enough information in the car to show that he had been in that car. You know, he'd got his books, his notes, whatever. So he had no awareness of the law.
I'll ask one more question, then I'll let you move on to whatever else you want. I didn't want to sidetrack you, but is there evidence in Florine similar to what you have here from the witness, Mr. McKinney, who says that the defendant didn't have any knowledge? Is there similar evidence in Florine?
I'm sorry, I'm not grasping the question, Your Honor.
So in Florine, you're saying that there was constructive possession. My question for you is, was there evidence in Florine from another witness that says the defendant didn't know anything about what was in the car? Or is that something unique to this case?
I don't think there was anyone in Florine who said he didn't know what was in the car. But, I guess you're referring to McKinney saying that the gun was his and he'd put it in the backpack. I don't know how that helps where the state is claiming McKinney basically he's a liar, and that the jury, in light of the state's argument, I don't think they were going to go just based on what McKinney said. You can't, in that instance, concede that he knows the gun is in there and expect McKinney's testimony to carry the day. That's just too damaging an admission or an error by defense counsel. And, you know, if you look at the transcript of the post-conviction hearing, I mean, it's obvious that, you know, it's like counsel got ready the night before, he'd never seen the case, and throws together a defense without even thinking it through. That really is, I think, a fair way to summarize his performance at the trial. It just makes no sense to defend on the basis he did, you know, to try to maintain or allow the state to establish and essentially concede himself that he knew the gun was in there, but he doesn't have dominion and control. The gun, you know, nobody would do that. Is there anybody who would contend that that's a, that he or she would defend on that basis? It's crazy. He threw the defense away. So, you know, and the point I was wanted to make sure I covered is that, you know, the state's point is that all defense counsel is doing is referring to what the cop told Mr. Morrison at the interview. Again, the jury had that was not true. That just did not happen. And the jury had no way to know that because defense counsel didn't play the scales tape, and the prosecutor at the trial elicited a very narrow slice of what happened in the interview. And defense counsel did nothing to correct that. As far as the jury knows,
Mr. Morrison is being interviewed. Is there to see that discussion during the police interview about what was found in the home?
Your Honor, I couldn't hear that last part.
Well, I mean, isn't it fair to assume, wouldn't the jury reasonably listen to the evidence and listen to closing arguments and assume that the officer had advised the defendant why he was talking to him and what had been found in the car?
I don't know how the jury would assume that. If you look at his testimony, the officer was asked, did he, Mr. Morrison, make any reference to anything that you found in the car? The defendant just kept telling me that he was going to have somebody call me, and he didn't specify as to who that was. And there's nothing that does any more than that to give the jurors an idea that, oh, the officer must have told him what was found. No, that wasn't it at all. The state, again, wanted to use this interview, try to portray the interview as showing a consciousness of guilt on Mr. Morrison's part because he's making these somewhat oblique statements and not coming out and discussing the gun. Well, again, if you read the scales transcript, the officer never says we found a gun there. At the post-conviction hearing, Mr. Morrison testified that, yeah, I knew there was they'd found a gun because I was at the scene and they said I'm being arrested for PC weapons. And then he had gotten paperwork at the jail showing he was being charged with felon in possession. So he knows they found a gun, but that's not being brought out in the interview and the way the state tried to characterize the interview. So, and then just to cover, some other aspects, this was an implied admission of guilt. Morrison did not acquiesce in it. He had no really idea of what was happening. It was until the closing argument. He's there at the end of trial, and then suddenly, defense counsel is saying, does knowledge of the gun. And again, that statement, does knowledge of the gun, make you in possession of it. That was not something that, Morrison had agreed to, had no way of knowing what was coming, or you could say that.
Can you discuss the timing of the knowledge in the context of the statement? I mean, the lawyer's statement is, he knows there's a gun there, right, based on what the investigator is telling him.
And that's false because, first of all, the jury had no factual basis to credit that. They never heard what was said at the scales interview. So there, to say that that's what the officer was telling them, there's no basis for the jury to believe that. They don't know that. It's just Mr. Muhammad. And now the state saying, "Well, that's what I was referring to." Muhammad or Mr. Morrison, didn't agree to it. He really would have been.
Can I just focusing you back on that for just a moment? Assume that the scales interview had been played for the jury, and that the jury would then be able to make the connection between the statement of the first, the predicate statement and the explanation. That is, he knows there's a gun there based on what the investigator is telling him. Does that defeat your argument, if that were the circumstance?
No, because I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor, because even if that had been brought up, the officer telling him at the interview that we found a gun, how does that establish knowledge the day before, 2 days before, when Morrison was in the car? Okay, that's after the fact. In other words, Morrison's knowledge at that point that a gun was found, that's after the fact. That's not at the scene. So it doesn't help at all.
But then it wouldn't be an admission of guilt.
The problem is the jury doesn't know that. If they had heard the Scales interview, possibly they could have pieced all this out.
Right. That's why I was asking hypothetically. If the jury had heard the Scales interview, then this would not be an admission, correct?
Well, possible, but you know, the way Mr. Muhammad is arguing this, I wouldn't be confident that the jurors could figure this out. I mean, I had to keep reminding myself, okay, yeah, right. Even if he had been told then, that would have been after the fact knowledge, not proof that when he was stopped, he knew the gun was in there. So Mr. Muhammad was keen on pursuing the no constructive possession defense. In other words, even if it's sitting in my lap in this, you know, I don't know what in the backpack, I don't have control over it. That's where he was going. So I, Your Honor, I don't think the jury would necessarily have grasped that point and come to Mr. Morrison's rescue. So unless there are I'm out of time.
You are out of time. you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you like to use
that. Thank
you. Counsel for the state.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel John Schmidt, assistant Hennepin County attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The closing argument was not a concession. The focus here is one sentence out of an 11-page closing argument out of a 488-page trial transcript.
Well, I know there's a lot of language in our case law that says, you know, we don't take little bits and pieces out of context in light of the entire argument. But if a defense lawyer makes only one statement and the statement is my client admits his guilt, then it doesn't matter if there are pages and pages of closing argument transcript, does it? I mean, aren't we here focused on the quality of the statement more than the quantity? It seems to me, or do you disagree with that?
Well, I in the hypothetical situation, if a defense counsel stands up and says my client's guilty, then yeah, that's a problem, no matter how many pages of transcripts you have.
And in this case, we have, at least from Mr. Nyvold's perspective, defense counsel saying my client knew the gun was in the car.
In this case, we have a hypothetical question that defense counsel posed in the context of a longer closing argument. And the question that counsel asked is, does knowledge of the pieces of property in the back of your car make it yours? He was using that in context with the iPad example that he was giving in the closing argument. And so in the context of the entire argument, it matters that that is a hypothetical question that was raised. In particular, it matters.
Well, it's not entirely hypothetical. He's not talking about the iPad when he says he knows there's a gun there, right? That doesn't sound hypothetical.
But the rest of the sentence matters. He knows there's a gun there, right? Based on what the investigator is telling him. So it's based on what the investigator is telling him. And that is key context for that. And I understand counsel's argument about the Scales tape not being played. And he is exactly right. I cited that in my brief, and he corrected that in the reply brief, and that is accurate. Scales tape was not played to the jury. The quote that I gave was not in front of the jury. What was in front of the jury is testimony from the officer of talking to the appellant.
Right. So if we could pause just for a moment there. So the jury is instructed that what the lawyers present at oral argument is not evidence. So if you hear the lawyer say something that's not in the record, just disregard it. I think that's what jurors understand there to do with statements of fact. So you have this based on what the investigator is telling him. So if I'm a juror listening to the instructions of the court, I might be inclined to disregard the qualifier based on what the investigator is telling him and accept the statement of fact based upon a lawyer and client relationship and knowledge the lawyer would have. He knows there's a gun in the car. He knows the gun is there. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that approach in analyzing the argument?
Because of the statement based on what the investigator is telling him is supported by facts that was presented to the jury. On page 247 of the transcript, the officer was asked, did you interview Mr. Morrison? And the officer said, yes, a few days later. And then he was asked, did you talk to him that day, though? I did. It was very brief. I believe I told him he was under arrest for a firearm. So right there is the fact that puts it before him that he knows he's under arrest for a firearm, that there was a gun found somewhere after the point that Mr. Mack, the passenger, Mr. Morrison, the appellant, were put in separate squad cars. At some point in time, as the police searched that car, they found a gun, and he told them he was under arrest for a firearm. So that is the fact based on what the investigator is telling him for point one, that he knows he's under arrest for a firearm. Point two is the officer did testify about his understanding, his interpretation of what Mr. Morrison was telling him.
Yeah, put you on. Can I pause you just for one moment? Mr. Nyvold, if you would please put your microphone on mute. I think you're...
Sorry.
You've got an excellent microphone, and it picks up your breathing. So we know you're alive, but I think we should let Mr. Schmidt have a little bit more floor. If you could, Mr. Schmidt, recognizing what you've just said, let's assume that this is so, that there's enough for the jury to understand that the knowledge that he's talking about when he says he knows there's a gun in the car, it's based on what the investigator told him. How does that timing relate to the actual argument that Mr. Muhammad then goes into, which is, does the knowledge of the piece of property in the back of your car make it yours? It doesn't. You're not in possession of it. Possession means dominion and control. It seems clear here that Mr. Muhammad, regardless of the statement about the investigators, what the investigator told the defendant, Mr. Muhammad's argument is focusing on the fact that the defendant knew at the time before he was informed, that he knew about what was in the car at the time possession might be established. Can you address the argument?
Well, I think that could be an interpretation of that, but I don't know that was necessarily picked up by in the context of the entire argument. I suppose by picking this one sentence out of context, it is possible that that's...
Well, how was that out of context? I think I'm putting it in context. Does the knowledge of the piece of property in the back of your car make it yours?
So in context, I think it's still about what the investigator is telling him. I don't know that that is, because that's the sentence right before that, based on what the investigator is telling him. It's not necessarily, I think you have to connect those two sentences. Mm-hmm. And that is the full context. It's not that does knowledge that it was there for the last several days make it his, make it possession. It is knowledge based on what the investigator is telling him. And so one, he knows he's under arrest for a firearm. And two, the officer testified about his interpretation, the officer's interpretation of their conversation during the interview, the Scales interview. Now, the Scales interview wasn't played, but the officer's interpretation was that he felt that Mr. Morrison was talking about the firearm. when somebody kept, when Mr. Morrison kept repeating, somebody's going to call you about that. Somebody's going to call you. The officer's interpretation was that is about the firearm. So the evidence before the jury was, one, he's under arrest. Two, the officer believes that they're having a conversation about a firearm because that's what he's under arrest for. So based on what the officer is telling him, that there's a gun that was found and you're under arrest for this, that is the lead in to the hypothetical question that comes after that. And I think this is supported by the rest of the closing argument where defense counsel made arguments that Mr. Morrison is not guilty, that no one saw him with a gun, that there's no fingerprints on the gun, that Mr. Morrison never has been seen in possession of a gun by anybody else. It was within the strategy that this was McKinney's gun and that Mr. Morrison was completely unaware of it. And then I think, as Judge Bryan noted, it is an alternative argument of, if the officer is telling you there is a gun that is in the car, does that make it yours? And the argument as it goes on is, no, it doesn't. McKinney put that gun in his car without his knowledge. He had no idea it was there, so you can't find this person guilty. I think that is the trial strategy that exists here.
If I may, Mr. Schmidt, let me put it this way. Do you agree that the dominion and control case was a strong one?
The evidence
supporting dominion and control, that this case really only was about knowledge, because it sounds like Mr. Nyvold is arguing that for defense counsel to try and do this alternative argument regarding dominion and control, equating ownership with possession, that itself is ineffective. And so I guess I'm asking you, do you believe that the evidence of dominion and control was so strong as to make that pivot itself ineffective assistance of counsel, as Mr. Nyvold is arguing?
No, I don't think the pivot itself would be ineffective assistance of counsel. The issue with the gun being found where it was in this backpack was extremely problematic for Mr. Morrison. There was a lot of photograph evidence that was put in of everything else that was in the bag that was consistently showed that Mr. Morrison owned the bag, that it was all his stuff. There was nothing else in the bag that could be pointed at that belonged to Mr. McKinney. And so there is a very strong inference that everything in that bag, including the gun, belonged to Mr. Morrison.
But I think Mr. Nyvold would agree with that and would argue that that's exactly why it would be ineffective to try and make the argument that defense counsel did, that really all you have to do is argue actual knowledge, and that's it. And if you go beyond that to say that there was no dominion and control, that itself is ineffective given the facts of this case.
And I see that point. I disagree that makes it ineffective, because there is a point in time here that it's a pivoting over to this thing with a hypothetical question based on what the officer is telling him with the gun. It's not a statement that says he knows there's a gun in the back of his car. Now, that would be problematic. This is, does knowledge of that make it yours based on what somebody else is telling you that it happens to be there? That is a pivot and a strategy decision that I think was made in the context of a otherwise strong denial of guilt based on no DNA, no fingerprints. Nobody's ever seen this person with a gun in the past, and he's not guilty. So I think in the context of the entire closing argument, this was appropriate. Now, lots of other defense counsel may not make that decision to offer that hypothetical question. Certainly, counsel wouldn't have made that decision. And he is arguing that many defense counsel wouldn't make that decision. But it's still a strategic decision that was made within the context. And under the Dukes case, and in the context of the entire closing argument, it was not ineffective. I'm happy to address any of the other issues that appellant raised in the brief, if the court would like to has questions. Otherwise, I will rest on the brief.
Does not appear. Is there any other questions from the court? Thank you.
It looks like Judge Ross. Ryan may have a question.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
You know, we do have a couple of minutes, and I know that this wasn't something specifically addressed, but I think it is of interest, and I'd like to hear what you would think. The district court cites to several Eighth Circuit cases interpreting Strickland, essentially to say that you can be ineffective, given the constitutional standard, in the manner and the questions that you might pose in cross-examination. That line of cases seems at odds with our own state court jurisprudence, which would suggest we don't look to trial strategy. And most of the time, those kinds of cross-examination questions are trial strategy. So I'm wondering if you might be able to address what seems on its face to be a disconnect between the Eighth Circuit law interpreting Strickland and state court jurisprudence.
Well, the state court jurisprudence would apply, and the state court jurisprudence, I believe you can look to the strategic choices made within the cross-examination. I'll be honest, I haven't dug into the weeds of the differences of the Eighth Circuit and the state court precedent on the issue, but our Minnesota Supreme Court jurisprudence would absolutely apply in any published opinions from this court. At least as far as the cross-examination of the officer, I do think those were strategic choices. This was about the perception, the officer's perception of the conversation that they were having. He felt like their conversation was regarding a gun. And counsel strategically didn't ask more questions about what the officer believed that conversation to be about. And it's supported by the direct examination testimony of the officer, too, where the officer said no to the question of, did the defendant make any statements to you about anything about the gun? And the officer said no. So it's supported with that, too, of why get into what the officer thinks this conversation is about further to make a strategic decision not to cross-examine on that issue. Unless the court has any other questions, we ask the state asks that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal? You're muted now, Mr. Neibold.
All right. Thank you.
You're allowed to unmute during your argument.
All right. Thank you. This is still a learning curve for me.
And for us all.
All right. This reference in the closing argument, and I believe this is Muhammad's closing argument, does his knowledge of the gun make him in possession of it? It doesn't. The jurors were not going to convict Mr. Morrison just because defense counsel might be referring to the officer telling him we found a gun. The jurors know that if the officer tells them we found a gun, that's after the fact. So that doesn't seem to be a way out for the state to say, well, that's the knowledge that Mr. Muhammad was referring to, that the officer is telling him this.
How would you have expected reasonable defense attorney to address the consciousness of guilt suggestion, but for to do it as trial counsel here did?
Well, I wouldn't say that, he has knowledge of the gun. The jurors are hearing him say he has knowledge of the gun, and he says, based on what the officer is telling him, but he's clearly indicating that he knows the gun is there. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So I don't see that that's a way to resolve the case. The jurors were going to take that and recognize that, okay, well, that means he knew the gun was there at the time he was driving before the police stopped him.
The jury would have to make an inference to that conclusion. Would you agree that that Mr. Muhammad didn't directly say that? What it appears he's saying in context is, based upon the investigation, the defendant knows. But the jury would have to draw an inference that the lawyer is really talking back in time to the point of the gun being in the car before the officer was involved. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and I think it's clear. He says, does the knowledge of a piece of property in your car make it yours? In other words, that really isn't tied to what the officer is telling him.
But it's in the context of him having just said that he learned it when the officer told him. The reason I'm asking this question is if we have to struggle to find that this was a concession, if we have to recognize the jury has to disregard the actual words and draw inferences, is that a clear enough concession to violate the behavioral prong of Strickland?
It is, because if you look at the overall context of the defense, it was not that he doesn't know. Okay, Mr. Muhammad does not say he didn't know it was there. The state never presented any evidence that at the time he was stopped, he knew it was there. His defense is essentially he knows it's there, but guess what? That's not dominion and control to have it in the backpack.
I'm asking you, in order for the jury to reach that conclusion that the defense lawyer is making the admission that he knew at the time, not based upon what the officer told him, but previous to that, at the time it was in the car, before the officers discovered it. If the jurors have to make inferential conclusions, draw inferential conclusions, is that a clear enough concession? In order for it to be a concession, yes, he has to be making the statement. In order for the jury to believe that's the statement he made, the jury has to take a couple of steps away from his actual words.
Yes, but Your Honor, the jury is almost always going to have to draw some inference, short of Muhammad saying he's guilty of this offense. They're always, regardless of what counsel says, short of a direct admission of guilt, they're going to have to draw an inference that this is a concession of guilt. So I don't think that precludes my argument. And the second thing is, he did not say Mr. Morrison didn't have any knowledge of this gun ever being there until after, you know, he learned from the police it was there. That clearly was not his defense. I don't think anyone would say that that's the basis on which he was defending. So by inference, defense counsel is not saying Morrison didn't know it was there. He's focusing us on the fact that if someone has a gun in the backpack behind them, they may be aware it's there, but it's not a crime because there's no dominion and control. But if you look at the instructions the court gave, those instructions just devastate that argument. It's obvious under the law that if he knows the gun is there, it being in a backpack in the seat behind him is dominion and control. So I think it's clear here the jurors were not proceeding on the basis, the defense is trying to get us to believe he didn't know it was there. The jurors would never have thought that on this.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you both for both your oral argument today and for your briefing in the matter. And we will take the matter under advisement at this time because it's submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.
Thank you very much.
This being the last case we have on our oral calendar today, we are in recess. So thank you for your argument. Be well. Stay safe.